Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Irene McKinney. Irene McKinney is the author of five books of poetry: Vivid Companion, The 6 o'clock Mine Report, Quick Fire and Slow Fire, The Wasps at the Blue Hexagons, and The Girl with a Stone in Her Lap. She is the recipient of an NEA Fellowship in Poetry and a West Virginia Commission on the Arts Fellowship in Poetry, and has held fellowships at McDowell Colony, Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, and Blue Mountain. McKinney taught at West Virginia Wesleyan College for many years and has been writer-in-residence at Western Washington University and the University of New Mexico. Her new book, Unthinkable, will be published by Red Hen Press in 2009. She is the Poet Laureate of West Virginia. Hi, Irene. How you doing?
I'm great. I'm really glad to be here.
Really glad to have you. I've been wanting to have you for years here, and here we are. So you're going to start with something from Vivid Companion.
Yes. I have been trying to write a poem about various years of my life. I kept thinking this would be a great project, but so far I've only got a couple of these. One of them from an earlier book at 19, and this one is at 24. At 24, I had written and read until my eyes were bloodshot, spending nights and early mornings in a fervor of page filling while the baby slept. I was writing to save my life as I knew it could be. I was writing to inscribe my body on a stone tablet, writing in defiance and silence. Nothing could stop me. I kept saying no to the paper. I kept saying, you can't have me, to the junior league, to the tiny streets, to impossible jobs and prissy motherhood. I was certain there was another way that didn't involve slavery, another way to love and work than the simian forms evolved so far. One morning, I drank 8 cups of coffee and wrote 4 poems, and I didn't even care that my head was bursting and I was lurching around while I scrubbed the bathroom. Another time, I left the children with my mother and lay in bed all day reading a biography of Van Gogh and groaning. What a life, what a life. I thought about Toulouse-Lautrec, that little freak. I was a freak myself, but only in private. I stared at his bronzes and terracottas and oranges until they pulled the color nerves out of my chest. That was a long time ago, and now I know that I knew nothing then, and if I had, I wouldn't have gone on. Dear Mr. President, I said, dear Dean, dear husband, dear our father, dear tax collector, you don't know me. I don't know what I am, but whatever it is, you can't have me. Here's another poem that seems like it's working towards self-defining, but I think of it more, I'm not defining myself as though there already is self there to be defined. It's more like I'm trying to create one. I'm trying to cobble a self together. This is called Constant Companion. 2 days enclosed by rain, hugged up in this room with no amusement but my voice. So now it's time to take off all my clothes and dance around alone. The belly scars, the pads of flesh, okay. And okay, the slippery breast with her soft, surprised pink seals. And equally okay, the body hair, the freckles, darkenings that flesh is bound for, the overlap and burn. Here in this rainy box, I've left it all outside. The crowded kitchen and the laundry tub, the judging looks. Except the birds. In their variety out there, they peep and croon, and there's an orchestra of black crickets. This voice is my constant companion, looking at the morning glories draped on a lovely thing of lathe and wire, a frame for burgeoning, cascading down in blue. You say it's not okay? You say it's unlovely, even ugly, the way the feet splay out, the way age grabs you by the face? Okay. I'm dancing to the Mahotella queens and singing along with their male groaners. Away, away. That's the kind of thing I do in here, where it gets as dark as you can get at night, and the air is saturated with rain and fog, and the voice, the bud of the voice, has a chance. I think poets do think about fame. They think about it because they hardly ever get it. And it seems like that in the small pond of the poetry world, everybody is sort of scrambling to get to a position where they're known. And I remember Keats talked a good bit about fame, and I think it troubled him because it seems like a contradiction for a poet to be thinking about fame. So this is my take on that. Fame. That I would become known. That someone would know me. I would be recognized and not pitiable. And I would remain as strong as I was, if not stronger. And overcome my circumstances through sheer will. And that others, younger or less talented, would not become known. Or at least not until I was. Then that recognition would reward me for all I'd undergone, my bravery of thought, my refusal of dishonest love, and my goodwill would be returned to me manyfold after the years and years. And I would not be bitter nor petty, nor would I act on selfish interests nor suppress my generosity. And none of this was me. I think the idea of scripting what you're going to do in your life is a big mistake. And when you think in terms like that, you know, when I get famous, this is what I'll do and that's what I'll do, is really a big fantasy, a big illusion, even if it would turn out that you became famous, which obviously I'm not going to.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Irene McKinney. Reading from her book, Vivid Companion. So you're talking about fame. Well, you know, a lot of people know you, Irene. I hate to tell you, but anyway, you know, in just one poem, you know, you can move from nature to body to politics to a voice that talks to the world. And, you know, I love how your poems move, and yet I can't put my finger on how it works. And You know, thinking about your work, I mean, I've read your work for years, and I had trouble finding questions because I don't know how you do what you do. But can you talk about that movement in your work that it seems so seamless, but you deliver us to a moment like nobody else can? Can you talk a little bit about the movement and craft in that?
Two things that I really have found after all these years that it's finally become clear to me what I'm trying to do. One of them is, I really want to sound like a human being talking. I just think that is so primary, to have the rhythms of speech and the vocabulary, at least to a large extent, the vocabulary of conversation. Now, obviously, real conversation does not have the stringency that we ask out of ourselves when we're writing a poem. But what I hope to do is to pick up rhythms of individual phrases and things that I would really say, and then transform them somehow so that they can fit in to the larger rhythmic structure of the poem. I pay a lot of attention to rhythm in all its forms. I don't know how obvious that is, but to me, that's a unifying thing that holds it together. And that's how I know when I'm at the middle of a poem and how I know when I'm nearing the end of a poem, is the rhythmic structure that it's making, that it seems to want to form on its own. Mm-hmm. So those are the two things I think. Conversation, real human speech, addressed to other human beings, not to a book, and not to any form of theory, but actually like people talking to each other as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And then the larger rhythm that I'm trying to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that sound and rhythm is definitely, you know, you can feel it, you can hear it, but it doesn't ever take over the poem. You know, it's just seems so organic in your work. But, you know, as you know, there are plenty of poets who don't pay attention to the human voice and how we really speak. What is your commitment to that? I mean, what's embedded in that? What do you, why is it so important to you to have that voice in there?
This will sound blunt, but I think that if you don't have that as a discipline, the way we talk to each other, it's easier to lie. It's easier to falsify experience, and it's easier to intellectualize or prefy experience. So I use it as really a check on myself. It's a way of calling myself to order that I think, do I hear this as a voice in my head? And if I can't hear it there, then I think, well, maybe I'm falsifying something, or I should be able to say this. I'm falsifying the experience, or I'm lying maybe in a big way. So lots of times in composing and revising, I'm listening, and I'm not saying that I can do this all the time. But I'm saying that it is a way to check myself out and make sure that I'm not just making up fantasies about my experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't mean lying about details or something that, or do you? I mean, do you believe it's fine to lie in poems about, you know, details to make things, make the poem work, or to, or are you saying that you want, are you talking about spirit of truth or literal truth?
I think in a way I'm talking about both. Obviously, I think all writers, poets and fiction writers and nonfiction writers have to sometimes fudge on details because you can't remember what the real details were, or you know that you're getting closer to the spirit of truth if you choose a certain detail that that didn't actually happen in the instance you're talking about. So in a way, I'm talking about both, but primarily I'm talking about the spirit of truth, that you can falsify human experience and you can make yourself sound a lot more heroic than you actually are. And I think that's always a terrible mistake.
Right.
I think any poem that has as its motive of the poet coming off sounding like a hero is going in the wrong direction.
Right.
We do.
Okay. Can you read some more poems?
Yeah. This one is actually about reading. I mean, reading is my passion and my love. And as I grow older, it becomes more and more important and precious to me. I just surround myself with books, and I'll read anything, literally anything that shows up in front of me. And part of the reason for that is that I was so deprived of books because I grew up in a very poor household, and we didn't have very many books around, and they were hard to come by. So anything I could find, I read. I remember reading my dad's book on farm machinery just because it was in print. In medical books or anything that was around. Fodder. So I was the scavenger child, waffling in filthy attics, scrounging for broken-backed editions of Edgar Allan Poe, covered with pigeon droppings, accumulating old yellow books from abandoned schoolhouses buried in the woods, smelling of mire and all abuzz with giant wasps building a nest in the pump organ. These were my fabulous loves, my secret foods. These were my handholds into shaky light, my emergence from the pit and loving the furniture of the pit, my dedication to the darkness and the shadows of fireflies' bodies found between the smelly pages, the vile effluvium of bookworms' paths, trekking with intention through one after the other, out one cover into the next, eating their way through shelf after shelf. Byron, Sheep Shearing in America, Kiss Me Deadly to Paradise Lost, and Lo, the Bird. Why should a hungry worm care what it ate? It was all paper and words, all black magic marks in an unmarked world, all height and depth and beautiful fodder, a method of moving the eyes until they brimmed with startlement, the swollen pupils reading themselves to death and up beside it and into it. This poem is called Hiding, and I'm still puzzled by the question that this poem raises, because I think about it in connection with so-called confessional poetry, where people confess all sorts of things about their lives. And personal poetry, which seems to be telling the truth about your life. And yet, here's the real mystery is, I feel like you never fully tell the whole truth, no matter how hard you try. This is called hiding. I have nothing to hide except my soul and body and maybe my family history. I have nothing. I hide nothing. But nothing is apparent nor disclosed. I speak the secret, and it remains a secret, even darker and deeper than before. I sit for hours staring at the morning glories. They are so audacious, and also the tufted grass and the windows of another house where people pass back and forth and bide their time, preparing to go out in the world and take their licks like I do. Only better, for many of them will concentrate on what's at hand, the getting and spending and adjusting and so on, and more power to them, I say, and mean it. But I can't do it. I'm incapacitated for it. I despise it in a way, but in another way, not. I'm stunned perpetually, and all the fire I've felt has burned holes in my head. The wind blows through, and all of my forgettings are rememberings seen another way. Part of what poetry does for me, and I'm sure it does for most poets, is to provide consolation in times when you're having great difficulty. And, of course, that's no guarantee that the poems that come out of those experiences will be good, but they can do you good. And when my father was in his final illness, he couldn't sleep. He had had a stroke, and he was very distracted and disoriented. And I used to sit up at night with him and look at the moon and write about the different phases of the moon. This one's called Full Moon, Sitting Up Late at My Father's Bedside. What can I say? The moon looms in the nighttime sky with brilliance, as it does. But we are going to touch it, and then it will go away. The animals on earth are breathing, but someone takes their hearts and puts them into broken human bodies. What can I say to those people? You took the heart of a chimp. You found you could do it, and you did. Secrets come out of the heart and nowhere else. We don't know how. What can I say when my father is dying, with his new eyes and his new heart? His mind is like a flapping line of laundry, clothing full of wind. How can I speak about the babble of his speech? His saying does not go from here to there. It's only here. Out of the dog came five pups. Slick, wet packets, each different. They grew at different rates. Some slept, two leapt around all day. What can I say about their secret selves, their paws, their separate ways of walking? What can be said about their natures and their flawed and perfect lives? I gave them away. They have a new trajectory, and I'm still here. I think about them every day. My father's manner is the same as it was when he was sane. Senility's a secret, too. It isn't vague to him. I see intensity in all he misconstrues. I think he misconstrues. The night is brilliant, and the moon's too close. It calls him out to where I cannot say.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Irene McKinney, reading from her book, Vivid Companion. Irene, you have some new stuff happening. You've been doing a lot of writing and have some books in the works. Can you tell us what's coming up?
The book that's coming up, I think, early spring from Red Hen Press is called Unthinkable, and it's selected poems. And it starts in 1978 and comes up to 2005. And another book that I just finished, I think it's finished, is a new book of poems. And a lot of those poems grow out of my recent illness. I'm a cancer patient, and I have a lot of poems about that experience, or that at least grow out of that experience. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a title for that one?
Yeah, I do. It's kind of a longish title. It might not work. It's, Have You Had Enough Darkness Yet? No, I haven't had enough darkness.
Okay. Yeah, so you've been busy.
It's been a very productive time for me.
Mm-hmm.
Very.
Mm-hmm. You know, your poems, you know, obviously have teeth, have guts, and they're physically involving. I feel like there's no way to read them and not feel and not rethink. And every time I go back to them, I know I'll get something new and important. So how do you create this kind of layered knowing in your work, or is that something you think about when you're writing or when you're revising? Because I always get something different, which is, you know, what you want from a book. But
I think what you said about the feeling or the physical, that seems to me like the most basic groundwork, that somehow or another those poems have to have a physical body, or I don't believe them and I think that other people won't believe them. And so I think you have to be willing to ground yourself in the physical, even when the physical has something shameful about it. I've been thinking a lot about the emotion of shame. In psychology, it seems to me, at least in the psychology I studied as a student, there wasn't a lot of talk about the emotion of shame. There were, you know, discussions of all the other basic emotions. But for me, shame is a gateway into truth-telling. It's another check I give myself. If I can write about a shameful experience, or to let a shameful experience be the key, then that keeps me very close to the physical body, so that there's a lot of physical detail as grounding, which makes the bottom layer, I hope, of every poem that I write. And I am conscious of that, more and more conscious of wanting to include everything physical about the experience that I can, even if some of those physical emotions are shameful.
Okay. Okay. We have time for some more poems.
Okay. I'll read just two from a previous book called 6 o'clock Mine Report. And this is the title poem from that book. Twilight in West Virginia, 6 o'clock Mine Report. Burgoo Mine Number 3 will work. Burgoo Mine Number 3 will work tomorrow. Consol Number 2 will not work. Consol Number 2 will not work tomorrow. Green soaks into the dark trees. The hills go clumped and heavy over the foxfire veins at Clinchfield, Wango, Greenbrier. At Hardtack and Amity, the grit abrades the skin. The air is thick above the black leaves, the open mouth of the shaft. A man with a burning carbide lamp on his forehead swings a pick in a narrow corridor beneath the earth. His eyes flare white like a horse's. His teeth glint. From his sleeves of coal, fingers with black half moons, he leans into the tipple, over the coke oven, staining the air red, over the glow from the rows of fiery eyes at Sego. Above Slipjohn, a 6-ton lumbers down the grade, its windows curtained with soot. No one is driving. The roads get lost in the clotted hills, in the blue spruce maize, the red cough, the Allegheny marl, the sulfur ooze. The hill cuts drain. The roads get lost and drop at the edge of the strip job. The fires in the mines do not stop burning. And I'll close with this. Sunday morning, 1950. bleach in the foot bath tub, the curling iron, the crimped, singed hair, the small red marks my mother makes across her lips, dust in the road and on the sumac, the tight white sandals on my feet. In the clean sun before the doors, the flounces and flowered prints, the naked hands. We bring what we can, some coins, our faces, the narrow benches we don't fit, the wasps at the blue hexagons, and now the rounding of the unbearable vowels of the organ, the O of release. We bring some strain and lay it down among the vowels and gladiola. The paper fans, the preacher paces, our eyes are drawn to the window, the elms with their easy hands. Outside, the shaven, hilly graves we own. Durette, Durette, Durette. The babies there that are not me. Beside me, Mrs. G sings like a chicken flung in a pan on Sunday morning. This hymnal I hold in my hands. This high, bare room. This strict accounting. This rising up.
The poetry of Irene McKinney. Thank you so much, Irene. It's beautiful.
Thank you, Jane.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased on Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner, Ben Cole, and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP. They don't have to be the beginning of a poem. They can be, don't even have to be a poem you've read, but something to grab people. So if you could pick something.
Let's see, there's one I didn't read that has, let's see. How many lines? How much?
2, 3, 4. Okay, wait. Okay, you got them. So I'll say, I'm Jan Beatty. This week on Prosody, I'll just go to you and then I'll come back. Okay. Hi, I'm Jan Beatty. This week on Prosody.
I was an ordinary woman, and so I appeared eccentric, collecting gigaws of porcelain and cobalt blue, mincing deer meat for the cat.
The poet Irene McKinney. Please tune in this Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers, 91.3 WYEP.